In this episode, we take a look at some recent efforts to warn people that Parkinson's and perhaps some other diseases, chronic diseases and so forth, are not being driven by bad luck or misfortune, but by, in large part, the chemicals that we voluntarily use and surround ourselves with. Welcome to the Call Like I See It podcast. I'm James Keats, and joining me today is a man whose best podcast takes are memorable enough that he definitely is considered notorious. Tunde Ogunlana. Tunde, are you ready to hit us with some of that machine gun funk today?
Yeah, man. It's funny because I'm a big guy, so I guess I'm notoriously big. Can I say B-I-G?
Hey, you do what you got to do, man.
am I too old to make jokes like this now? So I guess the audience will tell us on.
I don't know.
The YouTube audience will tell us on their comments.
We won't be the judge of that, sir.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, before we get started, if you enjoy the show, I ask that you subscribe and like the show on YouTube or your podcast app. Doing so really helps the show out. We're recording on August 26, 2025. And Tunde, we recently saw an article from OprahDaily.com. And it talks about a book. The book's called The Parkinson's Plans, and it's by two neurologists and researchers, Ray Dorsey and Michael Acoon. And the premise is basically that Parkinson's, which is a chronic neurological disorder, is primarily caused by environmental factors, not kind of like misfortune or bad luck or, you got this thing, which a lot of times it's attributed to that. Like, oh, unfortunate guy, he came down where he developed Parkinson's. And also, that this is something that could be treated, perhaps, successfully treated, and even better, prevented altogether. So let's start with the first part of the premise, Tunde. What do you make of this assertion that a very serious disease that, is hitting, a million people, that's something that's spread out there, that's out there, something like Parkinson's is driven in large part by modern pollution and chemical exposure?
Yeah, it's... Put it this way, it's sobering, fascinating, all that stuff at the same time, because it's like it's not a surprise for those of us who have just through reading just general media stuff, right, paid attention to the idea of pollution and how it can affect the human body over time. That's what I mean. It's sobering in the sense that it's another kind of revelation through an academic study of testing facts, using the scientific method in showing us that we are continuing to accept the idea of living in a world where we are just polluting ourselves and killing ourselves. And so it's also sobering because I know right now two people in my personal life that are going through pretty bad bouts as their Parkinson's is advancing. One of them is a gentleman in his early 70s that just broke his hip from falling because of the Parkinson's, the way he can't walk properly. So that's what I mean, like to read this and think, oh, okay, so these are things that if someone looked at a little bit tighter with regulation, like when we were kids and they regulated DDT out of the system and CFCs because of the ozone, layer stuff. I mean, you and I are young enough, but also old enough that we lived through watching the government actually do things that got some of these pollutants out of our system. And it seems like there's more and more evidence that there's more chemicals that harm us that we are exposed to on a regular basis, but we don't seem to have the same zeal for wanting to get it out of our system in terms of regulating out of, the industrial process of whether it's our food, our chemicals for dry cleaning, whatever. So, that to me is the sobering part. Actually, that it's just more evidence. Yeah.
I know you were.
You asked me a question, not just me.
Hey, man, I warned us all. It was going to come at us like a machine gun when you start going. So, but yes.
I missed that one, that analogy, but I appreciate it.
There you go. What's very interesting to me about this is that it's like, we as humans, as we've improved substantially in some areas as far as managing health and being able to live, we don't get a paper cut or whatever, a cut on a rock and then get a gangrene and lose an arm or die from an infection. We don't do that kind of stuff anymore. You know, like we've been able to make such improvements in certain areas as far as keeping ourselves alive. And you know, life expectancy going up and so forth. We don't die or get disabled from lion attacks, you know, things like that anymore. You know, and an infection really more than anything, because that's always been such a big thing that humans have lived with and people used to think was just bad luck, you know, like if you go back 5,500 years or something like that, or the gods, you know, or something like that. Like we've done so well with that, but it seems like at the same time, we've then introduced other ways to kill ourselves, you know, that weren't there before, you know? So it's like, if you didn't know better, you would think that we just kind of want to have these constant threats around us that if we get rid of some, let's just bring some other ones in. You know, like if you didn't know better, that's kind of what because that feels, you know, like, oh, OK, well, we solved this. So we got to make sure we create some other problem to worry about, you know. I don't know. I mean, I think it more so what really stands out to me, though,
seems to be happening in our other parts of our society. So it does, you're right. It does. I didn't think of it that way, but
I didn't as you pointed out, it's not really a surprise. You don't really blink an eye when you see this because it's like, OK, well, we know our food makes us sick. So it's not much of a leap to say that, oh, yeah, the stuff that people are spraying on their lawn or on the golf course or whatever, or the stuff that's going in our dry cleaning might be killing us, too. Like, that's not much of a leap, you know, and I'll say, like, it seems like from an industry standpoint for the last couple hundred years, basically the Industrial Revolution on, it has been a leap first. Hey, let's start doing blank. And then we can look second to see if it's killing people. And then if we see it's killing people or making them sick, we may or may not do something about it, you know, which is, I know, the point you wanted to get to, you know, this is like, all right, but so we've done a lot of leaping basically and introducing all this stuff in, like, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to put this chemical in there. We're going to spray this on all the grass that we walk around on, you know, and then we'll see what happens. And then if we see what happens, then we'll decide if you know, like there's going to be enough willpower behind it to get it out. So, I mean, moving to that second point, you know, like, so you see a lot of people talk about caring a lot about health and making people healthy and so forth. Or at least, you know, kind of like not killing ourselves slowly or making ourselves sick, you know, oh, dry cleaning chemicals may be making you sick or lawn fertilizers or, you know, things like that. It may be making you sick or might kill you. You know, you live next to a golf course, you're more likely to die because of what's happening on the golf course. Like, how are we able to see all this stuff on one hand and then not able to kind of align our behaviors with the idea of not walking into the lion's mouth?
I don't know, man. I think that it's so there's a couple things that I say. We have a lot of complexities in the world. I think it's a lot for people to try and keep up with all this stuff. Because as you're talking, James, I'm also thinking about other parts of our society, other threats we have. You know, whether it's, you know, the stuff happening overseas, whether it's things in the government, whatever. And it's just like, yeah, there's a lot we all as basically citizens of the country that are supposed to participate in, you know, whether it's the representative government or knowing about the food pyramid. There's a lot going on, right? And I think that so part of it is just our ability to get through a day and to be able to focus on what we need to do to kind of just sustain ourselves and feed our kids and do whatever we do as individuals to get through a day. And then, you know, there's a certain level of energy and ability to focus on other stuff. And I think that, like we're kind of talking about, James, both of us have acknowledged that when we saw this, we were not surprised. And so I think that is a tacit admission by ourselves that even we all are susceptible to falling in this trap of you just kind of accept it, right? And I'll share a story with the audience that I shared with you this weekend about my dog, who is a chocolate lab. So it is a, you know, Labrador Retriever, a pretty standard American family dog, not some exotic breed. And he's been having, you know, he's 8 years old. He's been having some skin rashes and little things like that. So we give him now, he's on 4 pills a day. One of them he's got to take 2 times a day. It's costing me around $200 a month. I was joking with my dog the other day because I looked at him as I was stuffing the pills into the piece of hot dog I was giving him and said, man, only one of us had a heart attack last year and it was me, but you taking more pills than me.
He also ages a lot faster than you though.
but that's why this is happening to his body. But that's why this is happening to his body, because you're right. He's old in terms of his own lifespan. And so what has he been doing? I've been feeding him since he was little, the food I've been told to feed him, which is whatever good brand of the dry food that I feed them, right? And now the vet is telling me that in order for me to help him get rid of this whole thing in the skin, I need to not feed him any of that food, and I got to feed him grilled chicken and rice for 12 weeks, and it should get rid of everything. And that's why I talked to you, and that's why I mentioned it now, because I was thinking like, well, hold on. Why don't I just feed him grilled rice and chicken in his whole life? Why am I wasting money, $100 on a bag of food that's supposed to be good? Why am I wasting money on all these pills when I could spend $50 a month buying some chicken thighs and some rice and making it once a week for him, you know, and feeding it? So that's what got me thinking, James, that now that the pet industry is like our human healthcare. And that's what I mean. It made me realize, oh, I'm just accepting the fact I got to feed my dog dry processed dog food.
Well, I don't think you're accepting it, though. You know, go ahead.
Well, I think like our society is just accepting. And one, and I'll finish on this. The one thing I shared with you in the conversation was that I can remember in the 1980s having pets and they didn't get these issues. They still ate dry foods. So that tells me that there's something, like you're saying, they're doing something else with the animal food, probably making it worse so that there's more profit margin. And then the other thing is that when my kids are my age, they're not going to have the memory I had. They're going to have a memory that, yeah, my dad used to buy pills for the dog, so I need to buy pills for the dog. And this is kind of how these things slowly creep up and become normal.
Just become so the norm, yeah. Well, I think yeah, you so answered now the question in your own way. I don't think you put it together. You started out, you're saying, why? No, we're talking about individuals. Why do individuals have a hard time of like comporting their behavior a certain way? One of it is, I would think, yeah, like you said, kind of like just the knowledge, you know, but the knowledge is out there sometimes. But you started out talking about how the world is complicated. Our lives are complicated. And so what the dog food, the bag, you know, dry dog food, what that's offering you from a transactional standpoint is ease of living, comfort, convenience.
Yep.
And so there's this balance of comfort and convenience and easiness that we do. That's the trade-off. The trade-off is it's not going to be as healthy. They're trying to convince you that it's healthy enough. Well, healthy enough for what? You know, like your dog has lived, you know, a pretty strong life for a dog, you know? So it's like, hey, we're not saying you're going to thrive your whole existence. We'll get you, you know, if you're a big dog, we'll get you 6 years, 7 years, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's going to all
fall
right. Eat this kind of stuff. So it's that balance. And I think, you know, like when you're talking about humans, you know, we do, like, we're looking at immediate threats, you know, and that's kind of what, and I honestly, you can see this online, you know, like in terms of how people are made afraid of things, like, and they're told these are immediate threats in order to get their attention online and so forth. It's the idea of, hey, if you do dry cleaning and then you throw it in your closet, keep it in the bag and all this other stuff, and you know, something may happen to you in 30 years. We're just not wired to kind of deal on that. You know, again, you know, humans evolved at a time when, you know, life expectancy might be 50 years or something like that. So it's not something that we do well with long-term threats and small changes in behavior to avoid long-term threats. But not all of us. Like for myself, for example, you know, like I try to account for this type of stuff. If I get dry cleaning, I leave it in the garage and let it air out, you know, take out the plastic, open it up, let it air out, you know, for a day or two before I bring it in the house. You know, even with the, like, I've thought it's crazy for a long time that we spray all this poison, these poison chemicals to kill all the weeds, not thinking that this stuff is bad for us. Like, it's poison. So all the sidewalks, everywhere we go, like, for my own house, you know, like, I take off my shoes when I come in the house, you know, and it's like, well, why? But people think it's like, because of dirt. And I'm like, nah, I care less about dirt. I just don't want all the poison that we have to, like, we have to step on poison all the time because people are, everybody's pavers has all this poison sprayed on it so that they, you know, doesn't grow. So it, you know, stuff doesn't grow there. And it's like, well, hey, things don't grow. That means it kills living things. So there are probably small steps we can take. I don't know if that reduces my exposure greatly, but it's something I can do, you know? So, hey, I can take off my shoes and then at least I'm not tracking poison around. Cause remember that's the kind of stuff, dirt you can wash off. No big deal. These chemicals are made to be resilient. Like they don't just wash off. They don't just break down or anything like that. They stay around. And so I think a lot of it is the balance, but people want, you know, like they don't want little weeds growing in their pavers and they don't want to get over there with the back-breaking labor of picking up the weeds. You know, I make my son do it because it's picking up weeds is tough.
Yeah, you don't want to be the guy with the weedy lawn and everyone else got a nice lawn.
Exactly, and so, exactly. And you got
that's kind of, it's interesting. You make
so my point being is just that we're balanced. We are making decisions. We're balancing comfort, convenience, ease, and we've just because the harm is so far off, we tend to lean more into the easy and the comfort and the convenient.
Oh, you make a great point. Because I want to just kind of follow on you, because the idea of convenience, I think, is great, and I didn't think of that, but I want to stay on it, because as you're talking, it also has me thinking of things like fast food, right? And I know that's not necessarily about chemicals directly, like what can cause Parkinson's, but we already know, and you and I have a library full of shows about how the dangers of the type of food we eat in the United States versus just you leave this country, what the difference in quality of food that you'll find. So,
and that itself is the definition of comfort versus long term. Yeah. And so,
that's what I'm saying. Like, because that's what I thought of fast food when you're talking about the convenience part of it. And this is where I want to be fair to a lot of Americans. This goes back to things like the relationship between industry and labor. You know, people having enough time in their daily life to actually do things to take care of themselves. And you know, if you only got 10 PTO days in a whole 12-month period, 365 days, and your boss is saying, I don't care if your kid's sick, if you got to stay home and take care of him, you're going to get one of your PTO days you got to use. People don't have time to cook a good home-cooked meal or to do certain things. And then what you're saying about your dry cleaning is very interesting, because think about it. You and I are both service professionals. You're an attorney. I'm a financial planner. We're lucky enough and fortunate in this environment that we have our own businesses and we run our own practices and all that. But there were times when me and you were younger, I worked in corporate America, a big 60,000 person Fortune 50 company. And you were the kid coming out of law school going to a big ass law firm in the downtown of a city. So guess what? We had to get dry cleaning, right? You can't show up to work in a wife beater and a pair of basketball shorts and expect to have a job. So
and you don't really have time to sit there and wash all your shirts and then iron them, press them,
That's what I mean. You're not going to do as good a job as a dry cleaner. So I remember when I was young trying to throw my clothes in the dryer, like the nice shirt. And it just, you got to show up.
Hold on. You would eventually, but there'd be some months in between. If you did that, if you're doing it every day or every week for a while, you would get better. But
I'm saying, James. But think about the advice you just gave, a little tip that just people, this is where the education piece comes in again. And that's where it gets frustrating, because then you got to do this with everything you do every day, which is one way to help the long-term negative effects of the chemicals that go into dry cleaning that they have cited cause Parkinson's disease. So this is not an if.
Yeah.
Is if you're fortunate enough, like we are, to have a house, then you just take your dry cleaning out of the bag and hang it up in the garage for a day or two and let it air out, let the chemicals get out that way. But if you live in a studio apartment in the middle of Manhattan, you might not have that luxury, right? Yeah. So but the first thing is knowledge. The first thing is even knowing that that's something you should do. Yeah. Because people with big ass houses don't know that.
Yeah, knowing that that's a threat.
That's what I'm saying.
And there's a way to kind of at least mitigate the threat to some degree.
Yeah, and to your point too, that from an evolutionary standpoint, where the fight or flight deals, with us not getting eaten by a lion. And so we're kind of built to look at threats that are in front of us immediately. But these long-term threats, just like why, and again, another part of life that, again, is complicated and people got to think about, is why most people don't save for retirement. Because most people just can't think 20, 30 years out. And not because they're stupid, just because humans aren't really wired for that. We're wired to think in more immediate terms for survival.
The retirement plan for humans for most of history is have kids. We're good at that. that's the retirement plan that we came up with from an evolutionary standpoint. This other stuff is totally different.
All my kids, as they get older, they keep moving away, though. So that's not going to work for me. I got to talk to my wife. That might not be a good reflection on us. Hold on. I just messed myself up. I gotta leave this show now and go have a conversation.
Well, I'll tell you this. One other thing, I want to move to the next section, but just real quick. The other thing I note, though, with this is kind of this, there is amongst, and I'm talking about now about the people that are motivated, that it's kind of easy to fall into a trap of absolute purity versus incremental improvement. And what I mean by that is that a lot of times you'll see these movements or these things where it's like, all right, we have to throw this entire thing out, and it's like that, it sets like an almost an unrealistic kind of expectation, one. And then two, it kind of sets you up for like, well, what do you do if that doesn't work? Will you just throw your hands up and give up, or you keep banging your head against the wall? Where I think a lot of times for our lives, because our lives are lived one step at a time, one breath at a time, one day at a time, there's a lot of improvement that you can make from an incremental standpoint. If you just can make small changes, incremental changes, and then repeat those day by day, then you actually can do, you can get yourself into a completely different place, you know, but that's hard, you know, like that's hard to kind of get that mentality, because a lot of times it's like we learn something, and you see this with these movements or these things, oh, no carb, and you know, all type, like it's endless, you know, like there's stuff now, like, oh, we got to get rid of all vaccines. And it's like, well, you know, okay. Yeah, there might be some stuff in vaccines that we need to be careful about, but I don't know if that means we need absolute purity or if we need to do this in a smarter way. Like, but I think for many of these, the personalities that are drawn to wanting to do something about it, this, the idea of absolute purity is so appealing that it kind of clouds this view or this ability to make incremental change and actually get yourself to a much better place, leveraging the idea that life is a step at a time, a breath at a time, a day at a time. And then you can use that, you know, it's like compound interest, basically, yeah. You know, put it in your terms, Tunde, you know, like you can make a lot of money using compound interest if you have time and you do things on a regular basis versus you got to make it all at one time, you know, so to speak. Yeah. So any last thoughts before we move? Because I want to talk society.
Yeah, today, I mean, but, yeah, I think it's because part of our, and I think this is today more in the American wellness industry, let's say of the last generation, this last 15, 20 years. And maybe it has to do with the internet and marketing and the fact that there's so many new businesses and different people propping up to sell things like the supplements and all that. In America, we have a high distrust for authority in certain examples. A lot of people distrust the government. I also think COVID exacerbated this a bit. So I think in America, healthcare, a lot of people have this individual feeling like, I know what's best for me. I'll give you an example, James. So remember, I had a heart attack last year. I'm on a statin and I'm on amlodipine, which is for blood pressure stuff. I had a good friend of mine visit me this weekend that I haven't seen in probably 2 years. He moved up a little bit further north in Florida. And the first time, I mean, we text and talk, the first time he's been to hang out. And we're talking about this, and he's big into all the other stuff, supplements, internet stuff, and all that. And I do take some supplements just to let you know, like for the prostate, certain things and Maleen for my lungs, you know, that do take some things. But he starts telling me why I shouldn't take a statin, why that's wrong, the side effects, and that I just need to change my diet to this and do that. And I don't argue with him, but in my head, I'm thinking, dude, this is where the problem is that my buddy's a computer programmer. He's got no medical training. He never been to med school. He might've read some stuff, but I don't know if he did, you know, really study biology ever or stuff like that. But he's going to tell me that the medical doctor and cardiologist who prescribed me a statin is wrong. And the problem is that, yes, I recognize synthetic drugs can have side effects and downsides and all that. But also recognize that a trained cardiologist also has some value and does know what he's talking about in certain areas when it comes to my heart. So that's where I think culturally as Americans we're at a little bit, which is this hyper-individualism that I know everything. I'm going to study it myself. No one can tell me what to do. I don't trust these experts anymore. And we've seen that in other parts of our society. Does create a more individualistic approach to healthcare, I think more so than in other societies, at least right now. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that that's true. But I think that the distrust that we've seen has been well earned. I mean, so it's a difficult piece. And this kind of bleeds into the societal piece, because why we approach it individually may stem from the individualistic nature of American society. But it also may stem from the fact that we've seen, you know, I talked earlier about how we tend to leap first, you know, from a business standpoint and look second. You know, when Vioxx is killing people in the 90s, you know, then it's like, well, there are plenty of doctors that were prescribing Vioxx, you know, and it's like, well, so how does that get through all that? So, I mean, the distrust is there, like, but this goes to my piece about the absolute purity part, you know, like I've seen compelling evidence as to why statins may be concerning, but I also haven't taken, I wouldn't come to you and say, hey, you know, this is because I'm looking at that from a place of confirmation bias. You know, so I recognize myself, like I didn't look at that stuff and then go try to refute, like follow the scientific method. I have that and I have some thoughts, but they're not thoughts that have been teased out and defended. So it's like, well, you know, like I will, in that case, defer to, you know, like, and just like you are, it's like, okay, well, unless I'm going to, from here in your mind, because you're a person that wouldn't just do anything somebody tells you to do, but unless you're going to spend the time not to just go from a confirmation bias standpoint saying, hey, I distrust this, so I'm going to find one thing that says I should distrust it and then run with that, but actually look at everything, you know, okay, I have this premise, let me see if I can disprove my premise and really go about it. If you're not sure going to do that, then it's like you are just kind of going into this and along the lines of what you're saying, like, oh, well, I'm just going to use my distrust to guide my decisions, which is not better than using absolute trust to guide your decisions. Like if you're going to guide your decisions based on absolute distrust or absolute trust, you're kind of in the same spot. You know, if you're
I'm laughing because you're asking humans to do something they're not good at.
Well, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Confirmation bias.
Yeah, that is our normal. But what I'm saying is that.
And to actually question their own thoughts.
Well, but that goes to my point of this purity piece. It's just like, okay, yes, because I'm skeptical of a lot of things, but I'm also equally saying, hey, well, unless I'm going to spend the time to really research it. Again, scientific method is you have an idea and then it's the opposite of confirmation bias. You then research and try to see if you can disprove that, which is why it actually leads to amazing discoveries, but it's really hard to do. So, but nonetheless, from a societal standpoint, I think you touched on at least part of it. You know, like we don't address these things right now as a society because we tend to try to approach all this stuff individualistically. I want to ask you why you think that is, and why as a society we have a lot of difficulty seemingly getting this stuff under control, particularly because it seemed like in the 70s and the 80s, 1980s, 1970s, society was on a trend to try to deal with this kind of stuff. You had Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, you know, like you pointed out, we're banning chemicals that are killing people and stuff like that. That doesn't sound, we don't operate like that anymore at all. In fact, the government's doing the opposite. They're saying, hey, yeah, you can put more pollution in the air, no problem. You know, like, so what's happening here? Why is a society we're so much worse at dealing with this stuff?
So, you know, Earth Day was promoted and basically created by the administration of Richard Milhouse Nixon. You know, it's interesting that he obviously, you know, he's got a bad rap for things like Watergate and maybe certain things he did
for lying. The Vietnam War. We don't even mind presidents lying anymore.
No, but that's where I'm getting at, James. Is seen as a very, he was, well, he was, you know, the break to the modern kind of Republican Party in a lot of ways and the post Southern strategy, all that stuff, right? But he was a very effective president in many ways and did a lot of positive things as well as some of the negative things. But this is like a time when, like you're saying, the environment was not a political football. You know, like, you know, when the lake in your home state, in the Erie Lake at Cleveland, caught fire, people understood, okay, if a lake's catching fire, we got a lot of pollution in the water. And so there was a concerted effort. Because remember, conservative people that live in rural areas like clean air and water, fishermen like clean air and water, hunters like clean lands and clean air and water, and so do people in the cities. So that was a bipartisan issue, just like healthcare was.
Well, conservative, you know, like in terms of before it became just like a title or a gang sign, it actually was about conserving things. You know, like that's, if you go back and look throughout history, like they were like, conservatives were the original champions of the environment, you know, and
you're right. That's who created national parks as a means to conserve.
Nixon created the EPA, to your point, but go ahead.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. That was the purpose of national parks, that, you know, to preserve the pristine nature of America for future generations.
That was a conservative thing before anything else.
Yeah. It's a conservative ideal. Everybody in the future could go to certain parts of America and see what it originally looked like. No matter how many oil wells we drill or skyscrapers we build. So, but you're right. I think in the last, you know, two generations, I think the internet is a big part of this, you know, the fracturing of our information system, because to your point, in the 70s and 80s, we were all kind of, you know, watching 80% of the country was watching kind of the same stuff and got the similar narrative. And I just think that there's this, like we said, this is not necessarily anything good or bad. It's just the way the culture has developed, which is a little bit of the hyper-individualism sprinkled with American capitalism and lobbying. So, these big corporations can lobby the government in a way that corporations and their companies just don't when we talk about the chemicals and food.
They can externalize their costs and internalize their profits by using regulation or lack thereof.
Correct. So I think all of those play into it. And I think now the public, understandably, is just frustrated and tired. And I think it's, like you said, they're like, we have a total right to be skeptical about pharmaceutical companies. I mean, you mentioned Vioxx. I was thinking more the OxyContin thing that, you know, that Sackler family.
Yeah.
They're worth $12 billion by killing 400,000 Americans. I mean, again, and this is about our priorities as Americans, because I bet you if I was in a coma and got told that in the last 20 years, 400,000 Americans were killed by ISIS, I'd be freaking out. Be like, what the hell's happened? You know, all this. But if you just tell me, 400,000 Americans got killed by a pharmaceutical company, again, we kind of just behave about it like the way we behave about this Parkinson's thing in the article. Like, all right, I guess this is how it is. So it's. I just think it's a combination of all of that. And I don't know where it goes from here, but it's.
I mean, you know, for sure, I think that that as a result, I think the information environment that we're in has contributed to it. The ability to kind of, like you pointed out, there were less narratives from the environmental standpoint, you know, and the lobbying piece was less effective at combating that, you know, because it's like, hey, oh, this stuff is killing us. Okay, well, there's a limit on how much lobbying you can do to buy a politician to say, hey, yeah, you can continue killing people, you know. So now I don't think that that's the case, you know. Like, it's like, okay, well, yeah, you know, we will just.
It was like, you got to kill them slower so they don't see
it. So it doesn't affect my reelection campaign, you know. Yeah, exactly. But I think what it is actually, if you look at the longer arc, then business actually has been able to get away with this for the majority of the time. What we may actually be, what our generation may actually live through is the idea that there was an anomalous period in the 70s, 80s. So you can bring the 60s into this a little bit, 60s, 70s, 80s, where the generation, you know, maybe the greatest generation and the things they had to, that they went through, from a depression to a world war, to being able to knowing how to work together to solve problems, to a media ecosystem that had accountability to the public and wasn't just all out to make money, where that era may have been an anomaly, where society was able to make things better for itself. And we may be back to kind of what's the norm, so to speak, where media and information is unconstrained and, you know, people can say whatever they want and it's all based on, can you deliver eyeballs, where the generations no longer have had shared experience of struggle and of sacrifice and working together that they can lean on to then make their world better by working together. Like that, we may be looking at that stuff and saying, oh, well, that's what we learned about growing up. Or, you know, and so that's something that is normal, when actually that may be the something that was abnormal and crazy, you know, in the grand scale of human history. And we're just kind of sliding back into to the norm of, you know, the people who are in control of industry deceiving everybody else, having them, you know, like fight each other about, you know, corporate logos and stuff like that, while they can continue to put hey, it's much cheaper to dump out a poison in the river or than it is to try to dispose of it safely. And if it's cheaper to do that, you can make more profit that way. So
I thought of a joke that, you're right, people care more about when a logo changes on a food company than what they actually put in the food. Exactly. I mean, right?
Quite literally.
And what they're consuming in their body, right?
Yeah, quite literally.
Yeah, it's a fascinating statement.
Because, you know, and that's because, you know, like they people are, the information system is set up in a way that allows people's emotions to get manipulated. And, you know, you it's a free-for-all, so to speak. So again, it may be looking back to what was is looking at, you know, kind of the anomalous period. And what we should be doing is looking back a little bit further when Teddy Roosevelt is coming out saying, hey, we need to preserve the parks. And he, you know, he had to fight really hard for that, you know, and he's trying to push against the oligarchy and the Gilded Age class and stuff. And so maybe we should be gearing up for that fight, as opposed to thinking that the model that worked in the 60s, 70s, 80s is the one that we can still tap into now, you know. So
we're going to have to gear up for it, because federal parks and lands are already being sold off to.
Yeah, and they're not being sold off to keep pristine. There's nothing conservative about that. So, but I think we can wrap this topic from there. You know, like, but, you know, obviously there's challenges for the individual, there's challenges for the society. And, you know, again, day by day, we could try to meet those challenges. You know, that's the only way. So we may not have the stuff to fall back on, know, in terms of the shared kind of, you know, shared sacrifice, shared commitment to each other. But those are things that can be built. And a lot of times they're built through adversity. And I think adversity is coming. So we'll have the opportunity.
Or James, I can go get a Big Mac. So whichever one.
Or that. So we appreciate everybody for joining us on this episode of Call Like I See It. Subscribe to the podcast, rate it, review it, tell us what you think, send it to a friend. Until next time, I'm James Keys.
I'm Tunde Wanlana.
All right, we'll talk soon.